Filmmaker Wes Anderson is identified with a type of style, one that brings out adoring fans and those who avoid his work altogether. There's a certain attention to detail, art direction, photography, and a quirky sense of humor with Anderson's movies. Critic and RogerEbert.com editor-in-chief Matt Zoether cites has not only tracked Anderson's career, but the two have been friends for about 20 years. The relationship culminates in the Wes Anderson Collection, a book full of essays, photos, and interviews on Anderson's work. Films like Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, and Moonrise Kingdom. I'm Jeff Bossert. Today on Focus, I'll talk with Seitz about his book, and we'll take some time to look back at the year in film and some Oscar contenders. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bossert. Today, we're discussing the offbeat films of Wes Anderson. He and film critic Matt Zoether Seitz first met in 1993 when the writer-director's first project, a short called Bottle Rocket, was shown at a festival. Seitz gave that movie a positive review, and Anderson made a full-length version of the film. And 20 years later, their friendship has resulted in the Wes Anderson Collection, more than 300 pages of essays, photos, and interviews on all seven of Anderson's features, movies like Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, The Fantastic Mr. Fox, and last year's Moonrise Kingdom. Matt Zoether Seitz is the editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com, the TV critic for New York Magazine, a finalist for the Pulitzer in Criticism, and the founder of two film blogs, The House Next Door and Press Play. He's also done a number of short videos on film history. Matt Zoether Seitz, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've seen a lot of Wes Anderson's films, and obviously you have as well, and you've kind of tracked his career, but I would like you to start out. For someone who has never heard of him and never seen any of his movies, what's a quick way of describing them?
Well, I don't know if there is one. I would say that he makes essentially fantasies. Even if his movies are set in the real world, they're not set in the world that we know. He's shot movies in Dallas, Houston, New York City, on the ocean, and in India and in Rhode Island, but he never names the place. And they often look like storybooks, and they often feel like storybooks. And sometimes they even feel like children's books, which is odd considering that the content is often R-rated. I think the closest equivalent is maybe certain French filmmakers who came around in the last decade, like the makers of Delicatessen and City of Lost Children and Amelie. It's in that wheelhouse. It's childlike and yet also very wise at the same time, his style.
Yeah, it was something you used to describe Royal Tenenbaums in one of the videos. You have these video essays that are kind of like video versions of the essays that are in the book. You describe Tenenbaums as being filled with Anderson's stylistic tics. I thought that was a good term to use.
Yeah, well, and he has a lot of them. I mean, he loves to. In fact, it's funny because imitating Wes Anderson has become a great pastime among filmmakers, and some of them do it for purposes of parody. There was a wonderful parody of a non-existent Wes Anderson horror film on Saturday Night Live not too long ago, and they really nailed it, I think, and I'm told that they used the video essays that I did as part of their research on how to mimic him. But other filmmakers just sort of naturally adopt his style in the way that, say, Wes Anderson adopted certain stylistic mannerisms of Martin Scorsese, who's one of his heroes. But I think the key thing that really separates Wes and that marks him as a unique talent is, even though you can sort of imitate superficial aspects of his work, you can't really make a Wes Anderson film. Only he can do that. And that says to me that there's some kind of unique, original energy there that goes beyond how he frames a shot or what sort of music that he uses.
We'd love, if you have any questions for Matt Zoether Seitz regarding the films of Wes Anderson, whether you love them, whether you hate them, your calls are welcome at 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Well, Matt, talk about how you and Wes Anderson first met.
Well, I was a film critic at the Dallas Observer, which was the alternative news weekly in Dallas, Texas, which is where I'm from. And Wes is from Houston, Texas, but he studied filmmaking at the University of Texas at Austin. And there he met a young fiction writer named Owen Wilson. And they were in a couple of classes together. They became buddies. They started working on film projects. And they moved to Wes moved to Dallas with Owen and moved in with him and his brother Luke and Andrew, all of whom were involved in some of the early films that Wes directed. And they made this short film called Bottle Rocket. It was written by Wes and Owen, and it starred Owen and Luke Wilson, who at the time nobody had heard of. They were just some local actors, and they didn't have a whole lot of formal training either. They were just a couple of guys who were comfortable on camera and just had the knack. And they submitted this film to Sundance. It played at the Sundance Film Festival, and they were invited to be part of a Sundance filmmaking lab, which Wes later admitted that they weren't actually part of the lab. They just managed to get in and audit it, which I thought was kind of funny. And the USA Film Festival, which is the local film festival in Dallas, included the short as part of a program of shorts, and I happened to be the film critic who was reviewing them for a roundup of what was playing, and Bottle Rocket really jumped out at me because it was so assured. It was in black and white. It had this kind of mournful jazz score, and they even used a couple of cues from Vince Guaraldi's music for the Charlie Brown specials. And it just seemed like, I was shocked when I met Wes. I thought, I have to meet the people who are responsible for this, because I thought they're homegrown talent, there's really some true talent there, and I want to write a piece about them because I have a feeling they're going places. And of course, it turns out they were. And I knew that Owen Wilson was a young guy about my age. I think he was 23, 24 at the time, and we're all about the same age. But when I met Wes, I was shocked because he was also that age, and I thought it was going to be somebody considerably older because his movies did not carry themselves like the work of somebody who was young and trying to impress you. It seemed like a style that he'd been developing over the course of quite a long lifetime, when in fact he hadn't even started making movies until a few years before that. So that was the beginning of it, and I ended up writing a cover story for Bottle Rocket, for Dallas Observer, about the making of Bottle Rocket, that followed the production of the film from start to finish, and that was published in September of 1995. And that's still online if anybody wants to read it, but it's massive. It's like this New Yorker-length piece that covers every permutation of that production. And I stayed in touch with them after that. We're not like tight pals who go fishing together or anything, but we check in every couple of years when he had a new movie out or if I needed a quote for a story that I thought he would be interested in. Eventually this book was the result of that. And I interviewed him over the course of several days in 2011 and 10, and again a follow-up when Moonrise Kingdom came out. And the idea of the book is that it's sort of, I like to think of myself when I do books like these as a portrait artist. And the book takes the form of what I think is the style and worldview of the director, and that's why the book looks kind of like a Richard Scarry children's book. It's very, very colorful, and there's original illustrations that are done in a very plain, simple style. And it's an extremely visual book with a lot of sort of technical details, and I feel like this all kind of suits the kinds of films that Wes Anderson makes. They're whimsical, but they're also extremely controlled, and they're filled with detail. Like, you can watch his movies over and over and over again and still notice new things, which is one of the reasons why I think they're satisfying.
I will admit I have the Royal Tenenbaums poster, and for years I would look at it and go, wow, I didn't realize that was in the corner of the frame or whatever.
No, exactly. Exactly.
You mentioned that you're not real tight, close friends, and that was my next question. Does it seem like a taboo thing to be friends with a filmmaker, or how do you characterize your friendship with him?
Well, it's mostly intellectual. I mean, we get together, we don't talk about our personal lives. We talk about what movies we've seen, what books we've read, what music we're listening to, and things like that. And that's kind of how it's always been. I remember one time in fall of 1997, I talked to him on the phone for a couple of hours about the movies that we had happened to see in the preceding month and what was out at the time. I think Boogie Nights and Jackie Brown and some other movies were out, and that's it. I mean, you know how you'll have some friends who are I got engaged, or oh, I lost my job, and you call them to cry on their shoulder. That's not the kind of friendship that we have. It's more based around the media and the literature and other things that we're kind of consuming and thinking about.
So what other filmmakers do you talk about? I'm curious what filmmakers interest Wes Anderson.
Well, Wes Anderson has a very wide-ranging taste, and that's one of the reasons why his films are so rich. There are a lot of younger filmmakers who are you watch their movies and you go, okay, their favorite, not only is their favorite director Martin Scorsese, but that's probably the only serious filmmaker whose films they've ever seen, because there's not a whole lot else there but imitating Scorsese. And Wes has a lot of mannerisms that he took from Martin Scorsese, but he kind of made his own thing out of them. And but he's also strongly influenced by the French New Wave. François Truffaut is a huge, huge primary influence on him. And he says in the book that his first viewing of Truffaut's film, The 400 Blows, in college was the incident that made him think that maybe he wanted to be a director. That was sort of his epiphany, watching that movie. He's a big fan of Orson Welles. He loves all kinds. Pretty much if it's good, he's into it.
That's okay, even filmmakers today? Are there certain filmmakers he's tracking right now?
Yeah, well, he loves, I know that he loves Scorsese still, and Scorsese's kind of a mentor to him. And in fact, Darjeeling Limited was originally going to be set in Europe, I think in France, but then Martin Scorsese invited him to see The River, Jean Renoir's The River, which is set in India, and it was a restored print that Scorsese had helped supervise, and he immediately got it in his head that this movie should take place in India instead. So that's a way in which Scorsese is a very direct influence on Wes Anderson. But as far as contemporary filmmakers go, he's omnivorous. I mean, and that's one of the things that impresses me about him. I interview a lot of people in this business, and I've learned after a while to not ask people who make film or television what television shows you're watching, what films you're watching, because a lot of them don't watch that much, amazingly enough. But Wes does. He's very active. And I know that he likes, he finds Quentin Tarantino's work really fascinating, and he particularly likes his work with just with, as a creator of characters. He really likes him. And and I know that he's always keeping his eye on films out of France and China and England. He's a big fan of the sort of English working class tradition represented by people like Ken Loach, who, strangely enough, even though he's a really kind of hard-bitten, almost documentary-style social realist filmmaker, his movies were an influence on Moonrise Kingdom, which is something you might not immediately guess if you were watching Moonrise Kingdom.
We'd love to hear from you if you're a fan of Wes Anderson films or you have any comments or questions about them. 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Matt, I wonder if you could kind of track the timeline between your two friendships, because you're of similar age and you've both really grown into your industries over that time. And just curious how those two careers have evolved while you stayed
well,
in touch.
Well, Wes released his first film in 1996. It was supposed to come out in fall of 1995, Bottle Rocket, but Columbia Pictures had a couple of test screenings that were disastrous, and he talks about that in the book, and they rescheduled. They kind of dumped it, I think, in January or February of the following year, and it opened in New York, and it was kind of funny and sort of sad almost, because he called me up, and this was the week before it opened, and said, hey, do you want to come see the premiere of Bottle Rocket in New York? And I said, sure. And he said, well, it's at 7 o'clock at this theater. And my wife and I showed up, and yeah, I thought there was going to be a red carpet or a party or something. But all he meant was that a bunch of people were getting together to see the first evening showing of Bottle Rocket, because they didn't get a New York premiere. But his next movie, Rushmore, was a very, very big deal. And in fact, that was the movie where I would argue that the Wes Anderson that we now know first announced himself. It's his first film in widescreen. It's his first film that really mixes some darker elements into the comedy. The main character, Max Fisher, is a kid who lost his mother a long time ago, and he's sort of still working through the stages of grief. That's a big part of who he is. And it just has a very melancholy sensibility that's strongly influenced by The Graduate and the films of Hal Ashby, like Harold and Maude in particular. As he started to move into progressively bigger and bigger projects, I started writing for bigger outlets. I moved to New York. I got a job writing pop culture criticism for the Star Ledger in Newark, which is the paper that Tony Soprano picks up at the end of his driveway. And I also became a film critic for New York Press with Godfrey Cheshire and Armand White, who were also on staff there. And it just kind of continued from there. I mean, it was kind of funny to think back on my first meeting with Wes, which was at a burger joint in Dallas called the Stonely Pea. because nobody knew who I was outside of Dallas, and nobody knew who he was even inside of Dallas, because Bottle Rocket hadn't really become public knowledge yet. And it was kind of considered a bit scandalous when it was announced that Columbia Pictures was going to produce a feature film version of this little black and white short film, and that James Caan was going to be in it, and it was going to be produced by James L. Brooks, because Dallas had a very thriving film scene at the time, independent film scene, and there was a sense of, why do these guys get to cut to the head of the line? Like, usually you make two or three independent films, and if one of them hits, then you get to go make a picture for a studio. And this was a Cinderella story, as Wes describes it. But in their case, as he put it, the pumpkin coach turned back into a pumpkin pretty fast, and they had to kind of start over again with Rushmore, which they did.
And he had some good stories attached to his films, like getting Bill Murray basically for nothing for that film.
Yeah, for nothing. And the part of the story that I love the most is that there was a point where he wanted a helicopter shot for the A Quick One While He's Away montage in Rushmore. And the studio said, no, we don't think that's a justifiable expense. It would have cost $25,000 to rent the helicopter for the day. And he told Bill Murray about that, and Bill Murray wrote him a check. He wrote him a personal check for $25,000, and he ended up not using the helicopter shot, and he never cashed the check, but he saved it. And Bill Murray worked for scale, and according to Wes, Bill Murray made about $9,000 from acting in Rushmore. But apparently that's just how Bill Murray rolls. He acts in a lot of smaller films for scale, and in some cases he has to be reminded to pick up his check for those projects. But then he'll go do something like The Voice of Garfield, and I'm sure he charges his full rate for that.
did you write about that first premiere with Bottle Rocket being, you know, so low-key, and then maybe compared it to the one for Rushmore?
Well, no, we didn't get into that, but I do know that the movie that really kind of put him on the map internationally was The Royal Tenenbaums. Rushmore was sort of a best-kept secret. It was not a big financial success. It got him an award. There's this award that the L.A. Film Critics Circle gives out. I believe it's called the Next Generation Award, and it's an award given out for the best second film, which I think is a fantastic idea, because people's first films are not, it's very rare that you get a film like a Citizen Kane where they pretty much knock it out of the park their first time out. It's more often with the second film that you really see the stylistic development of an artist. And he got that award from them for Rushmore. And I think Dave Keir of the New York Daily News put it on his top 10 list. I believe it was number one that year, which caught a lot of people by surprise. But The Royal Tenenbaums was his biggest hit up to that point, and it was the film that caught the attention of the international film-going community, and he started getting invited to film festivals overseas. And he had never really been outside of the United States at that point. Like, he wasn't a world traveler, and he got bit by the travel bug when he was touring to promote The Royal Tenenbaums. And it was during that part of his life that he fell in love with Italy, and specifically Rome, and he decided that The Life Aquatic, which was originally envisioned as being set off the coast of the United States, would instead be shot in Rome at Cinecittà, where Fellini shot most of his movies. And he hasn't really returned to the United States much as a citizen since then. He comes back occasionally for business and for family, but he's an international guy. He'll live, you know, when I talk to him on the phone, I always have to contact him via email and say, what country are you in?
Wow. Do you guys?
You don't really know. Like, yeah. He might be in England. He might be in France. I'm actually, after I get off the phone with you, I'm interviewing him again about his new movie, and I think I'm calling him in France. I don't know. But he's all over the place. And
well,
I think he wants to see as many countries as he can before he dies, probably.
Well, I've watched the trailer to that, the Grand Budapest Hotel, several times. That looks really terrific.
It's pretty amazing, I have to say. I mean, I think I'm supposed to not talk about it in too much detail because it's not really done yet. But
right.
I can say that it's a quantum leap forward for him in terms of its pace and its density of detail, and that's really saying a lot. And did you see Raising Arizona?
I did.
Okay, well, you remember the first 10 minutes of Raising Arizona? That's how the whole movie feels.
Oh, gosh.
It's like it's that fast. Like, it's like, it imagine, like, as I was watching it, I was picturing, like, somebody tap dancing while juggling, like, flaming bowling pins and chainsaws. I mean, it's kind of just the choreography of it is kind of incredible, and it just never lets up. And the plot's fairly complicated too, but you're never confused, which is remarkable. And Ralph Fiennes is funny. I don't know why it never occurred to me that Ralph Fiennes is just a stitch But he is. He plays the concierge who around whom the plot revolves, and he's great. He reminds me of a young Alec Guinness in this. He's very, very charming and self-deprecating and stylish.
Well, we've got some audio I want to play from a couple of films. Since you mentioned Royal Tenenbaums, and that really put Anderson on the map internationally, I'm going to set up a scene here the best we can do on the radio. We're talking about a seminal point early in the film. Gwyneth Paltrow, or Margot, the adopted member of the Tenenbaum family, the estranged family from their father. She gets off a bus arriving to meet her brother Richie, who's just gotten off a ship, and we're seeing her through Richie's eyes when this Nico song plays. So this is These Days. So does that? I had never heard the song until seeing the movie, but I wonder what that song brings to mind, and just the use of the slow motion shot that he incorporates in the film.
Well, it's interesting you should pinpoint that precise clip, because in the Royal Tenenbaums chapter, we talk about where the story comes from, and we also address it again in the Moonrise Kingdom chapter, where we're talking about music and the importance that music plays in his life as an artist. And music is very, very important to him. I think it's important to every filmmaker, but some perhaps more important than to others. And in Wes's case, it's a primary source. And one example is the Royal Tenenbaums, which he told me that when he was in college, he was browsing for CDs at a store in Dallas, and he came across a collection of music by Maurice Ravel, who's probably best known for Bolero. But there was a piece also on this called String Quartet in F minor, and he fell in love with that piece. And he listened to it over and over, and as he listened to it, he began to imagine this story about a family of geniuses in New York. And he said he originally pictured it being set in the 1960s and shot in black and white and probably having kind of an F. Scott Fitzgerald sort of feeling to it. But he imagined the plot while listening to Ravel, but the first scene that he imagined was Margot getting off that bus with Richie waiting for her. And he imagined that Nico song playing. And he often said that he tends to come up with these movies, these stories, coming up with images or moments and then thinking, what are these a part of? You know, like he's got the piece of it, and it almost reminds me of this great analogy that Stephen King used where he said that there's a metaphor for writing that it's like building a house. At first you build the foundation and then you build the superstructure and the rooms and the top it off with the roof and the chimney and so forth. And he said that was never his experience. And in his experience, it was more like you're wandering in a desert and you see this chimney poking up out of the sand and you start digging until eventually you've uncovered the entire house and it's all there and it's complete. And I thought about that analogy as Wes was talking about his own creative process, particularly how he would, in a lot of cases, just be reading or listening to music and he'd start daydreaming and suddenly stories and characters would begin to suggest themselves. And the implication being that it's all there. Mm-hmm. And it's only a matter of process how you dig it out. For some people, the idea of constructing something from whole cloth, as if, you know, you're sort of in a lab mixing chemicals, like some people work that way, but other people work more intuitively. And I think Wes may be one of those people.
Your calls are welcome for Matt Zeller Sites. We're talking about the films of Wes Anderson and his book, The Wes Anderson Collection. Calls at 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Another staple to his films are some quirky humor that just leave you kind of scratching your head but laughing at the same time. And I wanted to play a clip here. Very different film, The Fantastic Mr. Fox, a stop-motion animation film with a lot of familiar voices that we are used to hearing, some of them from his other movies. This is a clip in which Coach Skip, voiced by Owen Wilson, talking to Christofferson. This is Mr. Fox's nephew, voiced by Eric Anderson, explaining the rules of a game called Whack Bat.
Basically, there's three grabbers, three taggers, five twig runners, and the player at whack bat. The center tagger lights a pine cone, chucks it over the basket, and the whack batter tries to hit the cedar stick off the cross rock. Then the twig runners dash back and forth until the pine cone burns out and the umpire calls hot box. Finally, at the end, you count up however many score downs it adds up to and divide that by 9.
Got it.
Going for Ash. Substitution! Ash, come out! You need a breather.
What? Come out? What? I still feel good, Coach. Let me finish this 8th.
No. Come on. Step out. Let's go.
Am I getting better, Coach?
There's one character development, I guess, the relationship that develops between Mr. Fox and the nephew, who clearly has more talent to go out and help steal chickens.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's an interesting case, because that is the first film that Wes made that was an adaptation of an existing source. And all of his other movies, including Grand Budapest Hotel, are original scripts co-written with other people, although Grand Budapest is the first script on which he has sole screenwriting credit. Usually he's partnered with one and in some cases two other people. But that's a fascinating study in adaptation, because it is very true to the spirit of Roald Dahl in some cases. And Dahl, of course, was a very sprightly and cheerful and engaging, but also there was sort of a dark and even perverse undertow to it. And you see, it's fun to see how that's manifested in Wes's adaptation, because it's not quite as disturbing as the source material often is with Dahl, but there is a sort of an undertone of weirdness, like the way that the rat who guards the cider cellar dances like a character in West Side Story. I just love that, and sort of implies that Mrs. Fox was the town tramp back in the day, and Mr. Fox gets his tail shot off by the hunters, and one of the hunters appears on television to taunt him, and he's wearing the tail as a necktie. And that's a Wes Anderson touch, and he actually says in the book that the tail gets shot off in the book, but it was him and Noah Baumbach's idea to have one of the farmers wear it as a necktie in the movie. And he said that pretty much defines the essence of this collaboration.
But have you talked to him about where he comes up with his stuff, like a fake game that, you know, that takes a fair amount of creativity?
Well, it does, but it also seems like a natural outgrowth of just everything that he's about. I mean, he's a very detail-oriented guy. Like, he's sort of fetishistically obsessed with details and lists and pedigrees and release dates, and you can sort of see that in the way that he defines these worlds. And little details are always important in his movies, and sometimes they seem like extraneous details, but they somehow make the world feel more dense. Like, you look at the Royal Tenenbaums, it's New York, and yet it's not New York. And there's even a scene between Gene Hackman and Kumar Palana, who plays Pagoda. They filmed it at Battery Park City in Lower Manhattan, and they positioned Kumar Palana so that the Statue of Liberty was directly behind him, and they moved him so that he was blocking the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, anyone who wants to see some of these quirks should check out your videos on the RogerEbert.com site to talk about the book and really insightful essays on Wes's stuff.
Thank you. Well, but one of the things that, you know, is like what we were talking about, one of the things that really just makes me feel like the time I invested in this book was time well spent is the fact that I've been traveling to promote this book, and I've done a lot of readings and screenings and other events in New York, and then I did a tour through Texas and hit like four major cities in Texas, and at every single one of these events, almost, there was a screening of a Wes Anderson film. And by this point, I've seen Wes's movies, I don't even know how many times. I mean, 20 times minimum. Some of them, like Rushmore and Life Aquatic, I've probably seen 40 times. And every single time I watch these movies, I notice something new.
Well, do you get a new perspective on the filmmaking process and just how difficult it is and lining up shots, et cetera?
Well, I had a sense of that already because I have, you know, I've interviewed a lot of filmmakers and spent a lot of time on sets, and I've also directed movies myself. I mean, you know, not on the scale of a Hollywood film, but like indie films. And so I know sort of logistically what's entailed in that. But it's still fascinating to see how each individual artist works. Like, what is their what is their process, what is their method, and where do these ideas come from, and can they even explain it? And Wes is one of these guys who can't explain a lot of the deeper content of his films. It's very instinctive. And if you ask him, you know, why did you choose to shoot an anamorphic widescreen, or how did you build this set, or why did you decide to use real animal hair on the miniatures in Fantastic Mr. Fox instead of acrylic or synthetic? And he has an answer for that, and he can go on for at great length explaining his reasoning. But if you ask him why are there so many stories about broken nuclear families, or why does so many of these characters have issues with their parents, or why is the need to control things and the eventual realization that you can't such a key component of all of your stories, he doesn't really have an answer for that. And I think I don't think he's evading the question. I think he honestly, it's so deep that you can't really excavate it unless you're in therapy, which this interview is not, you know?
Yeah, we're talking with Matt Zoller-Seitz about his book, The Wes Anderson Collection. We'll talk in a bit more about just the year in film in the next few minutes here, but if you have any questions regarding Anderson's films, 800-222-9455 or email at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach us at Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. How do you defend his films? Because you Google Wes Anderson love-hate relationship, and I know plenty of people that just totally avoid his movies.
Well, I know quite a few people who don't like him also. And I don't know what to say about that. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't like, you know, they respect him. They respect his accomplishments, and they admit that he has a distinctive style, but it's not for them. I mean, I don't know very many people who think he's a bad filmmaker, but I do know quite a few people who, for whatever reason, just don't feel an affinity for his work. And I understand that. There are particular directors who I've never really embraced in the way that I have Wes Anderson films or the films of Whit Stillman or Woody Allen or Martin Scorsese or Catherine Bigelow. I mean, I'm just sort of going through the list of filmmakers I'm kind of obsessed with. Oliver Stone. I can't tell you why I love Oliver Stone's movies as much as I do, including the later ones. And I also love Wes Anderson. They would seem to have completely different temperaments, and yet there's something in them that speaks to me. And these things are mysterious and subjective. I don't, you know, I would never presume to try to sway anybody to liking Wes Anderson if they're not already inclined to like Wes Anderson, because I just don't think it's possible. I think you either feel in it or you're not feeling it.
Are there any other actors you know that he wants to work with that hasn't yet been cast in one of his films?
I don't really know the answer to that, and he's extremely, extremely coy about who he works with and why he works with them. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because a lot of times a filmmaker will announce, hey, I'm working on this new movie and I would really love for Colin Farrell to play the lead. Well, if you say that, it gets out on the press and suddenly Colin Farrell's agent reads it and they want a lot more money. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why you would keep that to yourself. And sometimes these things are very sort of mysterious and random. Like you run into a director might run into an actor at the buffet table at a party in somebody's house, and they start talking and they realize that they like each other. And the actor has a hole in his schedule next month, and there's a small part in this Wes Anderson film that he would be right for, and he gets cast on the spot. You just never know.
Well, we'd love to talk a bit about the year in film, too. Golden Globe nominations came out last week, and we'll do more of that in the second half. Anything else you want to add about the book and what you hope it helps show to people about the Anderson films?
Well, the goal of it is to this sounds a little strange, but it's about Wes Anderson and Wes Anderson's movies, but in another sense, the fact that it's about Wes Anderson and his movies is kind of incidental. The idea here is to explore the evolution of an artist's style over a long period of time and talk to them about that style and mix in some critical analysis of my own from kind of a slightly more detached perspective with a conversation directly with the artist. And Wes Anderson happens to be the subject of that. And there's going to be more books by me about directors coming out in the next few years. And I can't say who yet because the details aren't finalized, but the next book will not look or feel like this book because it'll be about a different filmmaker.
All right. Well, we're going to pause here for a short break. We're talking with Matt Zoller-Seitz about the Wes Anderson Collection. That book, by the way, is published by Abrams. And we'll talk more about the year in film in 2013 after a short break. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert. We're talking with Matt Zoller-Seitz. And we'll transition now talking about Wes Anderson films to the 2013 year in film. And Matt, do you make up a top 10 list?
I do. I haven't published mine yet because I'm slightly behind on my December film going, and I don't want to put that list out until I've seen all the things that I think I should see. But yeah, I do. And sometimes it's a top 10 list, and sometimes it's a top 13 or a top 20, and I've kind of changed the thing that I call it over the years. Sometimes it just says 10 best, and sometimes it's 10 favorites, and sometimes I rank them numerically, and sometimes it's in alphabetical order. I'm kind of uncomfortable with the whole idea of a hierarchy that is like a reading list, but with movies. But nonetheless, I indulge in it because people seem to enjoy it.
Well, there are definite contenders right now that will certainly line up on that fall on that list that you want to share with us.
Yeah, absolutely. At this particular point in time, the movies that I've seen that made the biggest impact on me this year were, well, I'll just give you the short list. 12 Years a Slave, I think, is an incredible film, and not just because the subject matter is powerful. You know, I mean, that almost sounds like I'm diminishing it to say this, but it's a film about slavery, and it's a big, harrowing, important subject, but it's just a beautifully constructed work of art. Like, every shot, every moment is very keenly judged, and it's all building towards a purpose in the way that a Stanley Kubrick film would back in the day. And I thought that was great. I saw Wolf of Wall Street over the weekend, which I enjoyed a great deal, even though it's quite a disturbing, perverse, kind of problematic film. It's big, it's bold, it's funny, it's sick, and it's challenging in a way that American studio pictures rarely are. I highly recommend it. You should see it just to have an opinion on it, even if you don't come out liking it. There's a movie called The Spectacular Now, starring Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley, that came out earlier in the year. It's a teen film, but it's the best teen movie I've seen since probably Say Anything back in 1989, and I've seen it four or five times in the theater now. I keep taking people to see it, and it's powerful. It's really a powerful, lovely, sweet film, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Best documentary I've seen this year was probably The Act of Killing, which is about a group of genocidal, participants in this kind of political purge in Indonesia, who are now in their 50s and 60s, and this filmmaker goes over there and says, "I want to tell your story, and I want you to tell the story for us, and here's some money. I want you to make little short films about your experience." And what happens is that in taking control of the story, these guys not only reveal their innermost sort of fears and fantasies, but also this guilt that they kind of insist that they don't carry around, that everything they did was justified, that the people that they killed and tortured were all just part of something politically necessary. But you can see through the art that they are creating, you can see that they don't believe that's true on some level. And the last 10 minutes of that movie are really, really something else, like almost a kind of like an less filmmaking than exorcism. It really shook me up.
Well, one of my favorite review, I think I've seen you write this year, is I looked it up at the weekend that Gravity opened. And not only did we agree on the film and both really enjoyed it, but I liked your some of the emotions you talked about in the film. Sure, it's in space, but it's not really about that. It's more about emotional interiors, is one quote I haven't. It's for all its stunning exteriors, it's really concerned with emotional interiors, is what you
mean
here.
It is, yeah. And I feel like the space, I feel like when I'm watching Gravity, what I am seeing is not any sort of a realistic, fictionalized record of a non-existent space mission. I think to fixate on the physics of it is a huge mistake, because I just don't think the film is about that. I think this movie, when I think about Gravity, what I think of is, imagine that you've gone through some kind of horrible trauma. And then one afternoon you lie down to take a nap and you have this dream where you're an astronaut and you are on a mission and a meteor hits the space station and you have to figure out a way to get back to Earth even though you no longer have a spaceship to travel in. It's like a dream. The whole thing feels like a dream or a nightmare, and it has a nightmare logic. It has this inexorable nightmare logic to it. And it's conceived in very bold, stark, simple terms. Like, and I likened it to a kind of a like a silent movie that would have been made in the years before sound came in, when I think silent filmmaking was at its aesthetic peak. It's got that kind of purity to it. The images really, really pop, and they're conceived in terms of metaphor. And anybody who's seen the movie knows what I'm talking about. But the last probably 5 minutes of that movie are just primordially terrific, I think. All is Lost, which is a very similar film, the one with Robert Redford surviving a shipwreck, I like that one a lot, too, and it kind of comes at the same subject in a very different way, although it's not so much about working through problems in a metaphoric way. It's more physical and real.
Well, the reason one of the things you brought up was The Wolf of Wall Street, and the Golden Globe list nominations came out a few days back, and it's listed as best motion picture, you know, comedy or musical in that category. So I'm glad you say it's funny, because there's a lot of times they have to fulfill that category, and some of these are really a question if they're actually a comedy.
Well, yeah, and you could certainly ask that question about Wolf of Wall Street. And you'll know what I mean when you see it. It's a comedy in the way that Goodfellas was a comedy, which is to say that the laughter catches in your throat, because these guys are greedy slime balls, and they are selfish, and they use other people, they manipulate and deceive other people. They're con artists, essentially, and trying to make as much money as they can, as fast as they can, consume as many drugs as they can, bed as many women as they can, and it's essentially an empty existence. But in telling this one guy's story, they're also telling a sort of a larger story about the mentality of America in the last 20, 25 years, where getting rich quick and staying rich is kind of the highest goal for a lot of people. And I think what I love about Wolf of Wall Street is the same thing that I love about a lot of Scorsese's earlier movies, which is to say they're telling the story of a particular person in a particular world, but they're also telling a bigger story that has political and social dimensions to it. Just in the way that Taxi Driver was not just about Travis Bickle, it was also about a kind of a feeling that the world was going to hell in a handbasket that was very common in the mid-70s. I think Wolf of Wall Street, it's set during the 90s mostly, but it resonates with what's going on now. I think it's great. I would not be surprised if it became a big hit, despite the fact that it runs 3 hours and it's got an NC-17 for sexual acts.
Well, the reason I was getting at the list of nominations is the Hollywood Foreign Press. I mean, they get a fair amount of abuse and from critics. I mean, how do you feel about the Golden Globes, and who exactly is the Hollywood Foreign Press?
Well, it's the Hollywood Foreign Press, and I have over the years attempted to discern how exactly one becomes a member of the Hollywood Foreign Press and what criteria, if any, keep you in it. And I've never been entirely satisfied with the answer to that. I don't really know who these people are, what their qualifications are, and it often seems to me like it's they give out awards so that they can have an awards ceremony and be in the room with famous people. And honest to God, that's a reason why a lot of awards-giving groups exist. A lot of the ones where you say, who the heck is that? Well, that's the real reason for giving out these awards. And legitimate critics groups are not that way. And I think for all its flaws, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and Television Arts and Sciences are not that way. They're a little more professional in why they choose things, even if their reasoning may be flawed. But, yeah, the Globes, you know, Ricky Gervais is right to make fun of them. Let's put it that way.
Well, the SAG nominations are out as well, Screen Actors Guild. Perhaps maybe there's a little more credence to some of these nominations?
Yeah, I think so. The SAG list is always fascinating to me because actors are brutal on each other. They're really, really not inclined. I mean, the professional actors, the serious actors that I know, are not inclined to give somebody a nomination just because they like them. There has to be something unusual or special going on for them to vote for somebody for an acting award, because actors are extremely competitive and jealous by nature, and they don't give out those kind of plaudits like they were candy on Halloween. So I love the SAG list. I love the Directors Guild list. There are often a lot of surprising choices on there, and they also don't have that aversion to what I call wounded puppies, by which I mean, you know, movies or television shows that were interesting but for whatever reason were not a hit. They don't care. If it's interesting, they'll nominate it for something, and I like that a lot.
talking about the year in film with Matt Zeller Seitz. Got a few minutes left. If you have a movie that you wanted to comment on or ask Matt about or recommend, 800-222-9455. Any buried treasures from the year? Maybe not a top 10 contender, but some things that we should seek out on DVD.
Well, with the caveat that my endorsement of this by no means is a guarantee that you're going to love it. But I have been recommending that people see Spring Breakers by Harmony Korine, which is a really tawdry, trashy, dark, kind of sick movie, but a fascinating one because it's hard to tell, you know, this story of a group of girls who become criminals and fall in with the criminal element during spring break. It's about the allure of crime. It's also about racism and white people fetishizing people of other races and appropriating their culture and sort of twisting it. And I don't think that it's entirely coherent in what it's saying and how it's saying it, but it's getting at some things that are very, very real, and I appreciated that. I also thought Upstream Color, which is the first science fiction film by this guy Shane Carruth, who did Primer, it was like 8 years ago. That one is really, really something else. It's a time-shifting story. I don't want to give away the plot because when you finally figure out what exactly is going on, it's pretty great. But I really recommend that. That's available on home video and for streaming. Upstream Color. It reminded me of a trippy kind of midnight movie from the 70s where it's told out of order and you've kind of got to piece together exactly what you're looking at and why.
Do you have a favorite performance of the year or maybe a couple of them?
Well, I'm a little too close to it, but I've been thinking about Leonardo DiCaprio's performance in Wolf of Wall Street. I was never a big fan of his work for Scorsese. I thought he had his moments, but he never really did it for me. I never went, aha, that's what he sees in him, until probably The Departed, where he had a supporting role. I felt like he was correctly cast in that. But this movie, I feel like he's doing something that only Leonardo DiCaprio could do. He's bringing an energy to it that only Leonardo DiCaprio could bring. And it's really just raucous and full of life, but also sad. And some of the things that he does to himself in this movie, in the process of telling a story, are you got to have a lot of trust in your director to do some of the things that he does in this film. He really abases himself in ways that I did not expect. But I would say that my favorite performances of the year are Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley in The Spectacular Now. Those spoke to me in a way that's almost beyond words. Like, it's once in a while you see a movie that, for whatever reason, connects with you in such a way that you feel like you understand yourself better. And I felt like I understood myself a little better after seeing The Spectacular Now. And I think if anybody out there has seen it and appreciated it, I think they'll know what I'm getting at.
Something we haven't really touched on is the RogerEbert.com website and kind of how you divvy up who does what. But I guess that's a nice thing to have so many different perspectives on that website.
Well, it is, I try to be very democratic in how I assign things, and there are certain people who have, for whatever reason, kind of popped with the readers, Christy LeMire and Glenn Kenny and Susan Wolosinska are all terrific. Odie Henderson, who I just think is one of the funniest film critics out there, is a regular. This guy, Stephen Boone, who is just really masterful in how he breaks down a film. It's a good lineup of people. I think the remarkable thing for me is when I've been looking at the site and the traffic that we're doing, we're a little higher now than we were when Roger was alive, which is kind of an amazing thing. And that says to me that the kind of criticism that people are writing there is in the spirit of Roger, not necessarily trying to imitate him, but trying to kind of find your own way and write something that is in plain language and personal and yet hopefully perceptive. And that's kind of the goal of it.
And we should point out the site has more than simple reviews on there.
It does, yeah. We also do articles about film history, film style. We review DVDs. We have a TV section. The TV section, Brian Tallarico, who's our main critic there, has been doing some wonderful work. And I let the managing editor handle Brian's pieces because I am also a television critic, as you know, and Brian has such a strong voice that I try not to read him because I don't want to be influenced one way or the other by what he has to say.
Is there certain?
He's very, very good at what he does.
Are there certain things, we're running just to a couple of minutes left, certain things that we should check out on Netflix since you are a TV critic?
Well, if you liked the previous seasons of Arrested Development, I really think you should see the fourth season, the long-delayed fourth season. That was my top pick for show of the year. I thought it was great. Hannibal, which is the NBC show based on Thomas Harris's fiction, I was a little surprised by how much I liked that because I'm not a big fan of the serial killer genre. I mean, there have been one or two films in that mode that I liked, but not too many. But this is something else. This one is a work of art. It really has that suffocating beauty of a great painting that you feel like you could just walk into. It's got an artist's sensibility to it that's extremely rare on a broadcast network.
I wanted to ask you really quick about the film Life Itself, the long-awaited documentary of Roger Ebert. It's going to be at Sundance next month. Any chance do we know if it might be at a certain film festival in Champaign in a few months?
Oh, I would say that's pretty much a lock, yeah. I'm sure it will be. And by that point, you know, it will have made its premiere at Sundance, and who knows, perhaps maybe somewhere else as well. But yes, I cannot imagine a scenario in which Life Itself won't be shown at EbertFest. And I will tell you also that I've seen the first 10 minutes of it, and it's pretty strong stuff. It's very, very, very frank in looking at Roger during the final weeks of his life, and that was something that Roger wanted people to see. He wanted people to see what the disease does to you and how you hold up. And it's just another chapter in the story of Roger's remarkable bravery and personal transparency that he would just be so open with his readers. It continues to amaze me, his openness.
Well, we've got to wrap this up. We've covered a lot of territory, so I hope some people have some recommendations to watch over the holiday season. Matt Zoller-Seitz, thank you so much. He's editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and author of the Wes Anderson Collection. Matt, enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Tomorrow on Focus, the topic will be personal finance. Jim Meadows is back in the host chair talking with Kevin Waspy, a chartered financial analyst, and Kathy Swedler, a consumer economics educator for University of Illinois Extension. For further thoughts on this program, you can contact us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus.